Everything Nicholas Snow is available at nicholassnow.com. For our video programming, check out nicholassnow.tv. Please subscribe to the show for free at iTunes or by downloading a podcast app from your favorite app store. Are you ready for a snowstorm of global proportion? Yes, over 6 feet of snow has just hit your podcast experience. And here he is, Nicholas Snow.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the show. We are live at 8 p.m. on October 20th, 2015, but my audience is worldwide and my episodes stay online forever. So who knows when you're going to actually listen to this episode, but whenever you do, you'll be glad that you did. My guest today is a quadruple threat. Actually, there's at least four talents that make this guest particularly impressive. He's an actor, he's a writer, he's a director, he's a filmmaker. He also speaks at least two languages that I know of. Arthur Allen is a Seattle native. He graduated from the Great Books curriculum of St. John's College in Maryland. After supporting himself for several years in the Seattle theater community and washing windows in the Space Needle, in 2008 he joined the United States Merchant Marines, where he wrote Winning Dad aboard the USNS Gilliland. In 2012, he was recruited by the Washington United for Marriage Coalition as part of its Speakers Bureau to campaign for marriage equality in Washington State. In 2012, he began working for an Arabic translation company and represented the United States at the second Baghdad International Translation Conference in Baghdad, Iraq. And Winning Dad is Arthur's debut feature film. The film was one of the selections of Cinema Diverse, the Palm Springs LGBTQ Film Festival, which happens every year. The film also screened at the Seattle Gay Film Festival. I don't know if that's the official name of that festival, but we'll work that out. At any rate, I watched the film today, and I cannot wait for this interview, and you're going to love it as well.
The snowstorm continues after this.
Spotlight on Palm Springs.
Come to Lulu, the award-winning California bistro. Fabulous breakfast, a luscious three-course Sunday brunch, scrumptious dinners serving fresh fish, perfect steaks, pizzas, salads, and more. Something for everyone. A three-course special to savor from $15.99. The best all-day and night happy hour. There's always a party at Lulu in the heart of downtown Palm Springs on South Palm Canyon and Arenas.
Hi, I'm Nicholas Snow. Many of you know that I am HIV positive. I'm living powerfully with HIV because I benefit from the services of the Desert AIDS Project in Palm Springs, California. And I'm very happy to bring you this news from another grateful client of Desert AIDS Project.
I'm more proactive with my health now, I think, than I was before. And I think that's because there's other people that are being proactive with me. You know, there's people that are interested and concerned about it.
A lot of services that are very difficult to access to HIV-infected patients are gathered within one roof. We do have access to substance abuse counselor, mental health services, psychiatrists. We have dental service programs. We have nutritional programs. Housing case management. Very unique in the nation that all the programs, including medical services, are administered within one facility.
Coming here, I felt just an amazing amount of love from Desert AIDS Project. They are people who just care in the community, people who want to put a hand out and say, let me hold yours. And I think that makes all the difference in the world.
For more information, visit desertaidsproject.org.
And now, on with the show. He's a regular contributor to the Huffington Post and to media outlets throughout the world. He's an author, singer, songwriter, actor, and activist, and the executive producer and host of NicholasSnow.tv. He has created and continues to do so a snowstorm of global proportions dedicated to connecting the circuitry of humanity. And now, drifting into the studio and your life once again, Nicholas Snow.
And I told you all about him at the top of the show, so without further ado, let me welcome to the broadcast Arthur Allen. Welcome to the show, Arthur.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So are you calling, are you in Washington State now? Do you live in the Seattle area?
Yeah, I live in Seattle, in Capitol Hill, which is our sort of notorious LGBT hub.
And what makes it notorious?
Just our history. You know, this part of Seattle just has a long history of acceptance and equality, and is where a lot of our gay establishments are based.
I love that. I love that. You know, I have to tell you, in my experience, if someone stars in, writes, and directs their own movie, you're either going to really like it or you're not going to like it at all. And I actually do really like your film, so congratulations.
Awesome. Thank you.
Did you ever question whether or not you should actually, I mean, clearly you were the writer, but did you question whether or not you should both act and direct? Was there any intense discussions about that with the people that helped you make the movie?
By the time the people who helped me make the film came on board, that decision had been made. But prior to them coming on board, that was definitely a discussion I had with close friends, I guess. It didn't last for very long, mostly just because I had what I felt were good reasons for doing so. One, as the director, I didn't have to, you know, hire someone else. Namely, I didn't have to pay for someone else, you know, because that would have been very expensive. And then also I felt that if I acted in the film, it would prevent me from micromanaging the crew and my actors, because I'd be able to just communicate to them what I needed and what I wanted to have end up on the screen. But on the set, in the moment of actually filming, I had other things I needed to worry about. And I think that was a wise decision on our set, because people really took ownership over what aspects of the film they were working on.
Well, let's backtrack a bit and tell me where you were born and raised.
Mukilteo, Washington, which is actually sort of featured in the film, that the ferry boat is the Mukilteo ferry boat.
Okay, and do you have a large family?
I have two sisters, two younger sisters.
And did you grow up in what you would describe as a supportive family, in terms of the fact that you were, you know, you ultimately grew up and came out of the closet?
Yeah, I would say, especially my community. I would extend it beyond my family and just extend it to the neighborhood and the community that I grew up in. My family, you know, they didn't suspect that I was gay. And I joke, because I think it was because we had two gay guys, two boys around my age who did come out of the closet in high school. And my parents just sort of compared me to them and said, well, he's not like the straight guys anywhere. And he's not even like these gay guys. We don't know what the heck is going on with him. They just thought I was eccentric. So in that sense, they were supportive. I mean, it did come as a shock to them for this reason. And there was an acclimatization period. Where they sort of had to let go of these sort of fantasies and images they had of me, you know, ending up with a woman and starting a family that way. But no, I mean, it was a wonderful place to grow up.
And when you were a kid, did you have this, I mean, you probably had several answers to this question over time, but what were some of the answers to the question, what do you want to be when you grow up?
I'm one of those lucky people who actually, by the age of 12, knew exactly what the answer to that question was and never deviated from it. I knew very early on that once I caught the movie bug, that was all I have ever wanted to do. And actually, every decision I've made, even professionally, has been in the interest of finally making a film. Prior to that, when I was, you know, a much smaller boy, I wanted to be either an opera singer or I phrased it, a professional tourist. I don't know what that meant, but but that's what my mom says I wanted to be.
And what inspired you to stay focused on that? I mean, what allowed you to persevere?
I think I took a sort of unorthodox route. I think the reason I knew I wanted to do it so well was because even at an early age, I found what is commonly called flow. I noticed that I could lose myself 8 hours without going to the bathroom or eating food if I was editing video, even way back when it was just VCRs. So when iMovie came out, I was gone. And so I knew I wanted to do that, but I knew I didn't want to go to film school. I had been reading a lot of books by other filmmakers and not just film, but theater directors and things like that. And they all emphasized that the job of a director is actually very amorphous. It doesn't really have a strong definition, and that the best preparation for it is a strong liberal arts background. So I realized that if I had wanted to be a cinematographer or a sound designer or, you know, a specialized aspect of film production, film school would be worth it for me. But as the sort of just dude there to, you know, basically criticize professionally in the moment, a background in liberal arts would serve me best, and that's why I went to St. John's.
How did you choose St. John's out of all the? I mean, how did you discover it and focus on it? Because it's clear across the country.
Yeah, St. John's came as a happy accident, really. The way I remember it is I got in a fight with a teacher in high school, and she sort of threw her arms in the air and said, "Well, how would you teach the class?" And I stubbornly told her exactly how I would teach the class. So I was thrown out of the classroom that day. But I think it was my dad who, in the aftermath of this encounter, stumbled upon an article in the Smithsonian magazine. The Smithsonian has a magazine where they profiled this very small, very old, unheard of little college in Maryland. And it just so happened that my rant to the teacher in terms of how I would teach and conduct classes was the way that this school taught. So it was sort of like film. It was love at first sight, and I never even entertained going anywhere else.
Okay, and how did you when you got out of school? You ended up back in the Seattle area, and it says you made your living in Seattle theater. How does someone make their living in Seattle theater?
I think maybe that's a bit stretched because, you know, it's basically what I can get away with saying that because I had a job.
I was
paid to perform. It was mostly the evening shows weren't quite as lucrative, but what sustained me were the educational tours where you would, you know, a gig wouldn't be 2-3 months. It would be 6 to 9 months where you and your troupe of actors would travel around the state visiting high schools, elementary schools, middle schools, performing these children's shows. And that was a weekly paycheck.
Ah, I like that. I like that. Now, one of the things I find is what fascinates me, I do not really know what the Merchant Marines are. And my impression of them is it's not something you would join to go lock yourself in a room and write a screenplay. But the way I've written your biographical material is that you specifically joined so you could write a screenplay. So how does all that work?
Yeah, well, it was interesting. I I was reading Moby Dick, and sort of got romanced by this. I guess it's not really an American tradition, but you know, writers Joseph Conrad, Moby Dick, even Mark Twain, who at some point in their youth took to the sea, and even if they didn't write at sea, it was very influential in terms of their later thought. And in my case, I was just unhappy. I wasn't feeling creatively satisfied with the theater work I was doing, I was sort of in this impossible situation where any money I made went right into rent and food. So I just felt like I was at a standstill. So shipping was a perfect solution because all the money I would make would go right to me. I got rid of my apartment. I had, you know, got rid of everything, liquidated all my assets so that I would live on the ship. They would feed me on the ship, and the money I would collect would be my own. So that was sort of the practical decision was, you know, there was a romance behind it, but it was also just, I felt smart. And so I did it, and my first trip had all the excitement of, you know, crossing the ocean and the wind in your hair. But my second dispatch, I got stuck on a ship that wasn't sailing anywhere in Jacksonville, Florida. it was like a $30 taxi ride off of the naval base we were on, and I was literally just stuck on that ship. I would put in my 8 hours a day chipping rust or, you know, maintaining the hull and things like that. But it wasn't going anywhere. So I felt like I was sort of stuck on an island, and that's where I noticed I really had the time to start writing.
So what are the qualifications to be a merchant marine? I mean, how does one even get
yeah.
a job like that?
Well, there's several ways you can do it. I mean, there's a hierarchy on the ship. So if you want to be an officer, you can either work your way up through being a sailor, or you can just go to a merchant marine academy and graduate with the required knowledge to be an officer. I was not an officer. I was one of the sailors. And in order to do that, you could go to I think it's a year-long course. We have one here in Seattle to become an able seaman. So you take a year of study. They teach you the knots and everything and navigation, basic things. And then you show up and you join a union and you go to the ship. The last option is to start out as an ordinary seaman, which is just basically sort of an intern on the ship, really. So you go to the union hall and just say, hey, I'd like a job on a ship. And you start out at the very bottom of the totem pole. And that's what I did. In terms of qualifications, it's actually a funny story, because the Merchant Marine has this ancient reputation for being, you know, almost pirates. And when I went into the union and I met the union rep, you know, he just goes through a very standard interview and, you know, asks me about my drug use. And he says, you know, do you use marijuana, cocaine, heroin, all this stuff? And I just answered, no, I'm a real clean guy. And he says, good, that's really good. And then he pauses and he looks wistfully into the sky and he says, you know, there was once upon a time where we wouldn't have accepted you with an answer like that.
That's very funny. I like that.
Yeah.
So I actually have successfully queued up the audio of your trailer.
Good. So
I'm going to play it, but before I do, let me just share the official sort of mini synopsis of Winning Dad. Colby's dad knows his son is gay, but he doesn't like talking about it. He respects it, but ignores everything about that aspect of his son's life. He doesn't even know about Colby's long-term boyfriend, Rusty. Increasingly committed to Rusty, Colby hatches a plan to trick his father into camping with Rusty under the pretense that Rusty is Colby's straight friend and future business partner. Colby is convinced that, given the chance, his father and his boyfriend will get along great. Before I play the audio of the trailer and take a break, is there anything you want to add to the synopsis before we get into part two of our interview?
No, I think that was just fine.
Okay, so I'll play the audio, and I'll be back with Arthur Allen after the trailer and the break.
Is he gay?
No, Dad, he's not. He's just a buddy. He works at the restaurant next door.
Yeah, it's still a couple of days I have to spend with a complete stranger.
Yeah, but he and I have been talking about going into business together, so I'm kind of hoping that...
So you're trying to get on a good footing, I get it.
Yeah, basically.
All right, I don't care. He can come, but he sleeps in his own tent.
Yeah, he knows, that's what I told him.
Well, I've got to get going.
All right. Thank you, Dad.
No problem. I'll talk to you before then.
Of course.
I better get going.
All right. I'll talk to you later.
Talk to you later.
I love you, Dad.
Take care.
Everything Nicholas Snow is available at NicholasSnow.com. For our video programming, check out NicholasSnow.tv. Please subscribe to the show for free at iTunes or by downloading a podcast app from your favorite app store. The snowstorm continues after this.
designer furnishings, sparkling cocktail rings, vintage jeans and shirts for moms, teens, boys, and flirts. Area rugs and stylish bedding design your wedding. Shiny knickknacks and glam Hollywood throwbacks. You'll find it here at Revival, voted best of the Valley thrift stores. Now with even more new treasures, plus one-of-a-kind consignment and estate items. Fashion, accessories, furniture, it's all in store at Revival. Find it here. Visit us at revivalstores.com to find a Revival store near you.
Hey folks, mark your calendars for early November because it's time for Greater Palm Springs Pride, Southern California's popular and longest-running LGBT festival in the Coachella Valley. Palm Canyon Drive is closed to traffic and transformed into a vibrant, pedestrian-friendly Pride festival unique to Southern California. Palm Springs Pride is also one of the sponsoring organizations of the annual Harvey Milk Diversity Breakfast, which takes place every year in May. Visit pspride.org.
The LGBT Community Center of the Desert is a nonprofit organization dedicated to enriching the lives of the LGBT community in the Valley through health and wellness, social and educational programs. The center advances its mission through a clinical counseling and internship program, senior programming, youth anti-bullying and suicide prevention support programs, a growing volunteer program, and signature special events in the community for its members and allies. For more information on the LGBT Community Center, visit them on the web at thecenterps.org.
All those paparazzi heard you were going to be on the show, Arthur, so they were like mobbing the studio.
Awesome.
You know, one of the things that now that I've gotten to know a little bit more about you in my own research and in our conversation, one of the things I notice about your film is that you use characters in the film to address particular issues that may not be central themes in the film, but that are probably really important to you. Am I correct in sort of that sort of assessment?
I don't know. I mean, it would, I guess, depend on
well, like, for example, the whole interesting conversation between two of the characters about racial profiling. That's sort of an interesting topic that the characters could be talking about in the kitchen.
Right.
And I was wondering, is that just incidental, or was it that an intentional that you wanted to have that kind of conversation show up in your film, of all the conversations that could happen between family at a kitchen table?
I guess. I think that one, that's why it's easier if it's a specific conversation. No, that one was very much just, I was just trying to characterize the girl. Because, I mean, the movie doesn't actually take up that theme at all. That was just literally while I was writing it that day, I was walking in the street and just noticed this bus and actually the person I was with made that comment and they sort of did it with some heat. I thought that would be perfect to characterize the sister. Jamie is the one who brings that up, as a sort of political flashpoint with her dad, just to sort of bring out this sort of cultural stances, him being a little bit more conservative and her being the stereotype of the bleeding heart liberal. And actually that scene, to be completely honest, that scene's not actually written. That's not in the script. Most of that first 10 minutes of the film is improvised. So that was just a story, a little tidbit that I told my actress for her to sort of riff on and to try her best to push the other actor's buttons. So actually, no, that was sort of an improvised bit.
Oh, I actually love that. As an actor myself, I love it when I have the opportunity to sort of improvise to an outline. I think that's just a fantastic opportunity for an actor.
Yeah.
So the other thing that I think that's very fascinating is that, you know, you worked in Baghdad. I'm going to say, was it during the Iraq War?
Oh, I didn't work in Baghdad. That was I worked here, but that was a trip I took. So I was there for about 5 days.
And was it during the war?
Oh gosh, no, it was 2012.
Okay, so it wasn't during the war. How did you? Are you fluent in Arabic, or did you just run a company that was really responsible for Arabic translation?
The latter. Yeah. No, I
the latter. And how did you end up in that? How did you end up in that line of work?
Well, I was the job I was originally with that company just through a referral, sort of an emergency, like, oh, I need to go take a trip. Will you take over this job? It's really easy. You can totally handle it. And so I sort of went in just as a simple project manager. But then this opportunity came up in Baghdad that they really wanted to take, and they sort of, my bosses were from Iraq. They're Iraqi. Actually, everybody in the company was in some form or fashion from either Syria, Iraq, or somewhere else. And they felt that if an American went to represent the company would be treated better, which, you know, I was treated like a prince. So we basically took advantage of my American passport and went over there to really make a splash. But then while I was over there, you know, they did so much prep work, you know, sort of telling me what the company did and how it operated in order to make me a real good representative of it. That when I came back, it was the sense of like, you know what, you know the ins and outs of it now. Would you like to be in charge of the other project managers? And so that's how that happened.
Wow, that's very cool.
Yeah, it was fun.
getting back to your film, is any of it autobiographical?
No. There's a few lines I think I stole from people in my life, but it's purely fictional. So much so actually that I had not had my first boyfriend even when I wrote it. So that whole relationship is just pure imagination. My first real boyfriend happened after we'd already started production. So
so life imitated art.
I guess. I mean, the relationship certainly didn't explode the way it does in the film. but I guess, yeah. I mean, yeah, I'm trying to think if there are any autobiographical elements, really. No, just certain lines, I think. I mean, you know, like, I certainly didn't do that to my own father or anything like that. So
one of the, I have a lot of filmmakers that listen to my show, among others, but one of the things I'm sure they would want to know is how did you make your movie happen?
The magic ingredient for that was Kickstarter. So we got $31,000 we fundraised on Kickstarter. And that's really, you know, the long and short of it. The first thing I did was I cast the film. So it was cast before anybody else was brought onto it. And then with that cast, I took some, you know, mock photos. I took them out for a weekend and we staged certain scenes, how they would look in the future film if it was ever made. And I took photographs of them in character. And using these photographs, I made a website to sort of give, you know, an idea for what I wanted the film to be and to look like. And so with that as a tool, I started, you know, meeting and bringing in other people to crew it up. And it was really when Julia Brooke, who's co-producer and director of photography on the film, when she came onto the project, she was originally brought in just for the Kickstarter video, but she, you know, worked so hard, we gave her director of photography, and she was really behind bringing the sort of technical know-how and the other hands onto the set. And so that's sort of how that was built up.
I love that. I'm curious to know, when did you screen in Seattle?
Last week.
So that was just last week, and that was that the first time you had sort of a hometown screening?
Yeah, that was. So the way I did it was I figured we'd travel and do the other festivals first, and then have a homecoming, sort of at the end of it. So yeah, last week was our homecoming where everybody got to see the film. I did also do a private screening for Kickstarter backers earlier. But that was just private and invitation only for people who had helped.
So this screening last week, how big? What theater was it in? How big was the audience?
Oh, it was amazing. It was pure heaven. The festival really was good to us. They gave us the Egyptian Theater, which is our sort of historic theater here on Capitol Hill, and I believe the seating is about 575 seats. And we filled the house. It was a Tuesday night, so normally I don't think the balcony is open, but we even had overflow into the balcony. So it was just a beautiful turnout. I was thrilled, and we got a standing ovation, and you know, it was magic.
Now, I know that probably all of you who were in the film had a decent amount of friends and family in the audience, but with an audience that big, there was probably a lot of people in the audience that were not predisposed to either love or hate your film that could have seen it with neutral eyes. Would you say that's true?
I'd say that's especially true because I think most of the friends and family that would have come came to the preview screening, the private preview screening. So actually, I some people didn't want to bother to see it twice, but some people did, and some people came back. But actually, that's why it was so impactful to me to see so many people that had never seen it before come to watch it.
I love that. Now, one of the things that I'm going to read your official words from your press kit because I'd have to agree with them. And I actually watched the film before I read this, and it made complete sense that this is what your material says. But it says, "When in Doubt celebrates the idea that family love strengthens romantic love, and that romantic love, even gay love, strengthens family love too. The stories about loyalty and sticking by the people you have decided are your family. It tells a love story to show that love between men, brothers, friends, lovers, husbands, fathers, sons isn't easy, but it is worth striving for, and feels that the highest expression of love between two men should be celebrated, not ignored." One of the things that your film does that not a lot of gay films do is that they actually deal with the family of origin of at least one of the principal characters. They're very much a part of the film. And it's not a coming out film. It's about completely different set of issues. Did you know you had sort of a unique story going into it?
I don't want to say I knew I had a unique story, but I knew I was seizing upon a unique moment in history. I think Winning Dad is very much in the tradition of American writers. I'm thinking here of, you know, James Baldwin, Gore Vidal, Truman Capote, and Tennessee Williams, of course, where these are things that have been talked about, but only circumspectly for the last several hundred years. And what I felt like I was doing, taking a situation that might be, for the most part, familiar, at least in the work of those authors, and being explicit about it, because now we can. I think the reason Winning Dad is novel and hasn't been seen before has less to do with me and more to do with the fact that we as a society have changed quite radically, really. And now I can just go and say and be very candid and very honest about what these previous writers had to sort of dance around.
That's a great answer. So, you know, you talked about how you personally, as Arthur Allen, your real person, read Moby Dick, and the character Rusty has quite this little mini monologue about how he loved the book. I would have to say that maybe that little monologue might be autobiographical. Were you as excited about Moby Dick as the character of Rusty?
I mean, probably not as much as Rusty, but but I was. It was a very. That's such a. It's a favorite scene. People love it because it has so much energy. But in terms of just the dramaturgy of the story, I'm very proud of it. Just in terms of the writing, nobody seems to notice it. But I like to think of it, at least if I may toot my own horn, as the fastest, most efficient charm offensive ever conducted on a straight man, because really in the course of 3 minutes. This character has won over his arch nemesis, so to speak. I just used Moby Dick for that moment. And it is very much a tribute to me being at sea and the influence of Moby Dick in that decision. But it's also, if we want to go into the sort of cryptic conspiracy theories about Winning Dad, it's plot is basically stolen from the Bible. It's the story of Jonah and the whale, where Mike the father is Jonah, the sort of the prophet with this calling to do some good, and the family is sort of the crew of the ship that Jonah is on, and they're in a storm, and they realize that to stop the storm they need to get rid of this prophet, And so they throw him overboard, and he's dragged down to the bottom of the ocean by a whale. Well, the way the story is conceived is that Rusty is the whale, dragging Jonah, Mike, the father, down to the bottom of the ocean, down into the abyss. So that's sort of, for me, connected the dots between the Moby Dick monologue and then later on, I don't want to give too many spoilers, but, you know, the ferry boat and a few other nautical references.
Well, I haven't, you know, I don't consider myself a reviewer, and maybe privately I might review friends' films with friends. I like to, as a journalist, talk about films and filmmakers. But one of the, so I'm not reviewing your film, but one of the things that I do want to say about it is I thought that the writing was very authentic. The acting is very authentic. You know, I didn't have to suspend my disbelief about the bulk of what was happening, and I found that the film took me to surprising places. It had twists and turns that were unexpected, and ultimately, I ended up at a really powerful place as a result of experiencing the film, and really appreciated it.
Thank you. Thank you. No, that's what we want.
Is there anything that you would like to say about the film and the process that we might not have addressed yet?
Sure. I think, well, I mean, of course, my main message is, you know, please watch it and please share it. I feel, and my experience screening it has been that we, in the country with the recent, you know, cultural change and now the legislation to follow it.
You're talking about marriage equality?
And marriage equality. It's interesting how within the gay community, among other, you know, people within the LGBT community, it's sort of happened and we're happy. But I guess I've noticed that there's a lot of people who are advocates of LGBT causes that in their own way feel like, you know, they did something too. It wasn't just, you know, the gay community that made this happen, but they're part of it too. And I've noticed that they've really taken to the film to sort of, you know, get some closure and catharsis for their part of that journey too. I was very interested, even when we fundraised it, how many people were it was just advocates really bringing in the funds to make the film. And so I'm always encouraging people, once it's out, I will be encouraging people to please share it, not just with, you know, the couple, you know, gay couple, who might want a Friday night movie, but with anybody really, because I think it's a celebratory lap for everybody that helped these changes come about.
Did you have a Q&A at your screening last week?
We did. Yeah.
What was the most surprising thing that was said to you during the Q&A?
Well, at this point, I think I've been to several festivals, so it's hard to throw a question at me that I haven't heard before.
Well, let's just in general, is there something that has come to you in any Q&A that you have found surprising?
The thing that I think is most surprising, I guess the question, what I look for, what I anticipate the most, because it's always a delight and is different every time, is to find out what scene struck a nerve in the audience, because I'm proud of the movie because it's different for every individual, but it also has regional differences. So it's very interesting to find out how regions will actually differ, and one audience in Boston, for example, will really feel that there was this one scene that made them cry and made them feel really, really strong, and that in a different city, like Seattle, say, it's a completely different scene that everybody tends to sort of gravitate to. This also applies person to person. Every single person has their own moment that was like the moment that made me cry or the moment that made me feel something very intense. And they sort of assume that other people shared that same moment, but it's actually different for everybody. And as a filmmaker, I'm privy to that. And that's been, for me, rewarding and fascinating. So I always look forward to finding out through the questions, you know, what was the scene that this audience really globbed onto?
One of the things that I appreciate about the film is that you as Rusty and your lead co-star are not your typical gay leading men. When you look at the types of guys that play the leads in gay films, it's not you two. It's not the two of you. I mean, you're both very sexy and attractive, and you have chemistry in your own right. But you're not the typical gay leading guy. Do you know what I'm trying to say?
I'm not exactly.
No,
I think you're saying we're not. You guys have
body hair. I mean, for one,
right?
Like, you know. I still don't quite understand what bears are, but you guys, you have, you know, you're most of the guys that I see portrayed in a lot of gay films are these, you know, very smooth, coiffed, sort of, you know, the West Hollywood type. And I found that you guys were very a very diverse, a different look at the kinds of leading guys that you can have in a film.
Yeah. No, thank you. That's, I mean,
you probably
don't know what the heck
I was talking about. But,
No. It cracks me up. I love it. I mean, my short answer, of course, is, you know, well, I work with what is available material wise here in the Northwest. I guess I see what you mean. Yeah, Jake, I found, I didn't really know Jake when I cast him. I saw him, he's Portland-based, and I saw him in a theater production. I think he was playing an Irish terrorist, I'm not sure. I met him for coffee, and we got along great, and I cast him, and he was perfect for the role. Yeah, no. I mean, if that comes across, I mean, I don't think I was intending for anything. You know, I was just looking for not to be cliche, but you know, somebody who could act the role in a wonderful way. And I didn't really hold auditions or anything. I suppose when, you know, if I had held auditions, if I had written the character without Jake in mind, you know, I might have put myself opposite someone more not to throw Jake under the bus, but more, I don't know, sculpted, I suppose. But that was never, you know, my intention.
No,
I think
that your characters come across as sexy and interesting, and the chemistry is there and believable, and I love it that your characters were multidimensional and well developed. Well, congratulations. Is there anything that you'd like to say about what's next for you?
Yeah, next up is, well, so on December 1st, we are releasing the film online. You can find it when it's out at winningdad.com, which is our website, our trusty website. I have, three more screenings at various festivals. Next weekend we'll be playing in Dortmund, Germany. Then we have one in Florence, Italy. And then we will be finishing out in Long Island in New York. And then it'll be ready to come out online. And so that's what's next for the film, is just finally being able to share it with everybody, because everybody wants to see it, which is wonderful. But, you know, it's been a long road. And then for me personally, I think I want to I need to refill my coffers, because I've sort of run out of money with this project. So I'm freelance doing video work now. And then for the next year, while I write my next feature film, I'm just going to concentrate on doing short, fun things. So please follow me on, you know, Instagram or Twitter. My handle is MovieMensch. Stick around and see what great stuff is coming in the future. We had a great team, so we can't wait to get everybody back together again to try again.
I love that. And your website is arthurcallen.com, and that's A-L-L-E-N, arthurcallen.com. Well, thank you for taking the time to be on the show. I really appreciate it. And this episode will live forever, as will your film. So I hope that it helps people come to know you and what you're doing. And I look forward to meeting you in person one day.
That'd be nice. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Have a wonderful evening.
All right. You too. Thank you.
You're welcome. I've been speaking with Arthur Allen, actor, writer, director, and filmmaker of Winning Dad. As you heard him say, you can go to winningdad.com. This movie is in film festivals now, but as you heard, it's going to be available online, winningdad.com. And, of course, that's arthurcallen.com.
We are, in fact, connecting the circuitry of humanity. All of us connected. Please continue to connect with Nicholas Snow on Facebook, Twitter, Periscope, Instagram, Google+, and other social networks. Everything Nicholas Snow is available at nicholassnow.com. For our video programming, check out nicholassnow.tv. Please subscribe to the show for free at iTunes or by downloading a podcast app from your favorite app store. This program is produced and copyrighted by Nicholas Snow Productions, LLC. Thank you for being a part of the snowstorm. We are honored by your presence.